Our reading this morning is from Luke chapter 16, beginning at verse 19. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar man named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away, with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I'm in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead were to go to them, they would repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead."
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm wondering, with the last-minute change of topic for the women's brunch from bereavement to contentment, whether we shouldn't change from a talk about giving to receiving, perhaps, and make it a bit of an easier morning for everybody. But we'll stay as we are. When Barry asked me a few months ago if I'd come up and talk about this particular parable, I read it and I thought, that's quite a challenging story and quite a complicated one in some respects. So I thought I'd better get a commentary out. And the first Bible commentary I looked at started with the phrase, "This is probably the most difficult parable in Luke." Thank you, Barry. Hashtag hospital pass, we put on that one. Let me just pray before we dive into it. Lord, help us this morning to understand what you were saying at the time that you said this. Help us to understand what it means for us today, and help us to change our lives as a response to it. Amen. We're going to start with a quiz about this story, which has a prize. I figure kids' church shouldn't be the only ones that get sweets on a Sunday morning. There's something unique about this parable that no other parable that Jesus gives us has. There's a unique feature. So this box of Maltesers goes to the person that can tell me what they think that is. What has this parable got that no other parable has? It's not that. Good try. It's not that. It's something about in the nature. There's something present in this story that's not there in any others. No? Yeah? Hell? Nope, it's not hell. Am I going to get to keep the Maltesers? Something to do with the characters. Barry, do you know? No? Oh, well done. Round of applause. Yeah, there you go. Done. There you go. Yeah, given the sermon's about generosity, I think you need to think carefully what you're going to do with those Maltesers. It's the only parable where there's a named character. Lazarus is given a name in this. We can sort of have a think about why. Actually, I was talking to a friend last weekend who said, I told him I was going to talk about this, and he said, they said there's two named characters in that story. He wasn't talking about Abraham. He said the dog. He said the dog is named. But you have to look in the King James Version to find the name of the dog. So, fool as I am, off I go, check the King James Version. And verse 21 says, moreover the dog licked his sores. So, you laughed more than I did, so... Lazarus is named. So, what that tells us is this is an example story. This is not a theological, you know, view of how heaven and hell work, and who will go to heaven and who will go to hell and the relationship between them. Jesus is not answering a question about the kingdom of God. He's giving an example story to illustrate a particular point of view, and that's why we have, you know, named characters, because he's telling a story. It's a good job it's not a sort of a theological exposition of heaven and hell, because it all seems slightly odd. You know, is it that rich people are going to go to hell and the poor people are going to go to heaven, and that in all of, you know, the sort of quadrillion stars in the galaxy and the space that God has available, he happens to place heaven and hell within sort of sight of one another so that the people in hell can see what's going on in heaven. It's just illustrative. What we have to understand is I think, a bit about what it's illustrating. So let's look at the point of the story. We know Jesus here is talking to Pharisees. And if you were here last week, you'll remember that, the story that we heard last week. At the end of it, the Pharisees were asking questions and making comments. And this story seems a continuation of the theme. It's the sort of story where I think the Pharisees are getting... Well, they're getting another good kicking from Jesus, really. You wonder why they kept showing up, frankly, when he was talking, because everything seemed to end badly for the Pharisees. But here they were again. What I want you to do is complete that headline. What word would you put in front of that phrase? Money, I heard somebody say. Would anyone put something else? Love of money. I hoped you'd say money, so thank you whoever said that. Because I think this verse, which is actually from 1 Timothy, is, I think, the most misquoted verse in the Bible. We hear the phrase, money is the root of all evil. Now, actually, the verse reads, love of money, which is important, is a root of all kinds of evil, is actually what it says when you look at the passage. So I know I haven't quoted the end of the verse right here, but the point I want to make here is love of money. And that's what, just before Jesus tells this story, the writer Luke says the Pharisees, who loved money, and goes on to talk about how they responded. This story is one of those stories that's going to make the Pharisees feel uncomfortable. And what we're going to do this morning, I want us to understand a little bit about how it felt for the Pharisees. Because I think stories are important in two ways. Stories are things that have a message to them, but stories are also things that create feeling in us. And I want us to feel the feelings that the audience, I think, would have felt when hearing this story that Jesus told. We're going to look at it from two points of view, because the other thing about stories is the way you feel about the story all depends on the character in the story that you most associate with and you most identify with. When I was younger, a cartoon that always used to be on was one called Penelope Pit Stop. And some of you, if you're similar age to me, or you had children in it similar age to me, may have seen Penelope Pit Stop. And the basic premise of the cartoon was always the same. Penelope would get herself in trouble. The Hooded Claw, I think, was the name of the evil man that would capture her. She would get tied up somewhere in some ridiculously complicated trap, and a group of midgets would rescue her, as I recall. I don't know why they're midgets. But, you know, the, and it was so repetitive, it got to the point where rather than associating with Penelope Pitstop and feeling relief whenever she got rescued, you know, me and my friends started to feel for the hooded claw, and we just wanted him to finally get her. Because it was just a sense of frustration. Isn't he going to get it? Oh, she's got away again. I can't believe it. Just get her next time. So it's all about what character you associate with. And there's a number of characters in this story. I don't just want to look at it from, you know, feeling that, you know, are we the rich man here, but are we Lazarus as well? So let's have a think about the rich man's point of view. I don't know if any of you here would regard yourself as rich. We're not as rich as those guys up there. This is the latest Forbes billionaire list, 2014, with Bill Gates at the top, who allegedly has $76 billion in wealth. That's certainly mega rich. And I'm not going to ask hands up who's rich, but I want you to think about whether you feel rich. But before you make a decision on that, I want you to watch this video.
Following, please, from Earth as a Village by Philip M. Haster, Stanford School of Medicine. If we could shrink the Earth's population of over 6.5 billion people down to a single village consisting of 100 people with all the existing ratios the same, it would look something like this. There would be 57 Asians, 8 Europeans, 21 Africans, and 14 people from the Western Hemisphere. There would be 52 women and 48 men. There would be 70 non-whites and 30 whites. There would be 70 non-Christians and 30 Christians. There would be no doctor, no nurse, no dentist, no hospital or clinic, and no school. There would be no safe drinking water. There would be no common language. There would be no electricity and no paved roads. There would be 70 people unable to read or write. There would be 50 people suffering from malnutrition. There would be one person near death and one person near birth. The entire food supply for the village would depend entirely on outside sources. 6 people in that village would possess 59% of the entire world's wealth, and all 6 would be U.S. citizens. There would be 1 college graduate, 1 TV, 1 computer, and the average person in that village would be a 13-year-old Chinese girl. Whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, we are all responsible for each other and the world, which is exactly the way it is, because consciously or unconsciously we have made it so. And while none of us made any of the rules that govern the universe, we do make all the rules that govern our own hearts.
That's difficult watching for me when, you know, I'm living in a house, I think, with 3 TVs. Certainly got more than our share of that. Let me give you some other stats about our wealth. And I'm talking about us, the people here in this room. According to Gallup, the polling company, the global average household income is £110 per week, the equivalent of. That's about £6,500 per year. That's the global average. So if you've got an income higher than that, I don't know how we draw the line between rich and poor, whether you say it's halfway or you need to be in the top 10%, but you're in the top half if your income is more than £6,500 a year. To be in the top 10%, that would be £900 per week, about £11,000 per year. The average wage in Liberia, just to give you some contrast of the size of the scale, the average weekly wage for a worker in Liberia is £2. It's about the value of that box of chocolates that I've just given away. There's another way of looking at whether we're rich or poor, and that's the way we live our lives and our lifestyle. And I read recently some work, some study that was done, where people are trying to understand the capacity the Earth has to sustain the current population. You know, what is the number of people that our world has the resources to sustain? Now, currently, the global population is just over 7 billion. And this study, and, you know, these things take a lot of guesswork, so, you know, there's probably a lot of error involved in this. But their estimation was that if everybody in the world lived like the average person in India, then the globe would be able to sustain a population of about 15 billion. So it could double in size if we all lived like your average person in India. If you live like the average person in our country, in the UK, then the globe could sustain 2.5 billion people. And we've already got 7 billion. To sustain our way of life that we live at the moment, 5 billion people would have to go. You know, that's quite startling. You know, the point is, however we feel about those super rich people, on global terms, we are rich. And if you're feeling, you know, a bit uncomfortable about this, then that's the feeling Jesus was going for when he told this story. He was going for that sort of itchy bum moment, I think, where everyone starts to feel a little bit uncomfortable about what they have. That's what the Pharisees would have been feeling at this point when he told this story. I think there was, you know, three key messages that I think the Pharisees would have heard from Jesus here. And the first is, you know, that Jesus cares about how we use our resources. And I use the term resources, not just money here, because some of us are rich in other ways. We're not all rich financially. And poverty for a lot of people is not just poverty, it's not just lack of wealth. It's lack of the resources and lack of the opportunities that some of us have. You know, I'm incredibly privileged, I think, in the sense that, you know, not only having, you know, financial security, but, you know, I think about my children, and I know when they grow up, when they're looking for work experience and job opportunities, the connections I've got through the different jobs that I've had and the business I've got will give them huge opportunity in their life that I know others won't have. You know, that is a resource, and one of the things that makes me rich and will make my children rich is access to that, and not all of us have that. So it's how we use our resources more widely. There's a joke about a rich man in a town, and the charity in that town that runs some youth groups realise that he's one of the few people in the town that doesn't donate any money to their activities. So one of the charity collectors decides to phone him and say, you know, well, are you interested in giving to the charity? And so the man replies and he says, well, do you know that my mother's very ill and I'm, you know, needs her operations are extremely expensive? And the charity person says, no, I didn't know that. And, you know, you're aware that my brother's blind. The charity said, no, I'm sorry, I didn't know about that. And that my sister's, you know, husband's left and she's been left on her own to raise 5 kids. Did you know about that? And the charity collector says, no, I'm sorry, I didn't know about that. And the rich man says, so if I don't give them any money, why do you expect me to give you any? And, you know, when I know we're not, you know, we're not that harsh. But handling wealth is a preparatory lesson for handling greater gifts. And I think many of the things that Jesus tells us shows us that. I think I've known maybe 2 or 3 people in my life who I think had, you know, had genuine gifts of healing. And none of them were wealthy. And homework for any Oak Hill students, maybe you can go out and figure out, was there ever a rich prophet? I don't know if there ever was, but there's a good research topic for you guys. So Jesus cares about how we use our resources, those that we have, and that's what he was saying to the Pharisees. There's another message in this, which is that Jesus cares more about your life than your death. It's a question about what it means to be saved. You know, are you thinking that being saved means it's about kind of going to heaven? It's a sort of fire insurance Christianity, isn't it? I'll be okay, I've secured my future. Or is it about being saved for now, for the life that you live? I once heard somebody say, eternal life starts now. It's not something you're going to get. You've already got it, so it's happening right now. The picture up there is of a... I don't know if this is generally the picture of him, because I'm not very good with dogs, but... if that's an Irish wolfhound, no, it's not a picture. It's not a picture of the person. So it's representative of the story I'm going to tell. I thought it was actually the boy in question. There's There's a story you might find actually circulating the internet at the moment about a boy called Shane, 6-year-old boy, who had an Irish wolfhound, which didn't look like that dog, whatever that is. And the dog was ill and needed to be put down. And Shane's parents decided that it would be good for Shane to see this. And it would be a good life lesson. And so he should come when Belka, that was the dog, was put down. And they expected Shane to be really upset about this. And he took it with real calm maturity. He just nodded when they said that's what they were going to do. They went to the vets, the dog was put down. And Shane was calm about the whole thing and just very soothing towards Belka as the whole thing happened. And his parents asked Shane afterwards why he was so calm. And I've got the quote of what Shane said in response. He's 6 years old. And he said, "People are born so that they can learn how to live a good life. Like loving everybody all the time and being nice, right? Well, dogs already know how to do that, so they don't have to stay as long." That's how he dealt with it. He knew at six, I think, what, you know, the Pharisees and maybe some of us, you know, haven't figured out, that you know, life is for now. It didn't matter that how long Belka had. If he'd lived the way he needed to live, then he had the time that he needed for that. So how we live matters. And that's, you know, what Jesus is saying with this picture of the rich man with a beggar right on his doorstep, saying, look, it starts now. There's a third point in here, I think, from the rich man's perspective, which is that Jesus cares more about our do's than our don'ts. The Pharisees, you see, coming from a school of thought, which is a thou shalt not school of thought. Thou shalt not murder, and thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not boil a goat in its own mother's milk. You know, all the different rules and things that they had seemed to be prohibitive. And Jesus came with more of a you should rather than a thou shalt not. You should do this. You should love your neighbor. You should share the good news. You should give to the poor. And this story is making the point that whatever, we don't know anything about that rich man's life, but, you know, whatever rules he may have been keeping, he was not doing the thing that was right on his doorstep, that was obviously the right thing that he should be doing, and taking care of somebody that needed. It's a mirror of what can be sometimes the classic, you know, non-Christian defense about salvation. You know, well, I haven't murdered anyone and I haven't broken any laws, well, not any big ones anyway, so, you know, so I've lived a reasonably good life. It's not about what you haven't done, it's about the choices you have made when you had the opportunity to make them. So let's switch it around. There's three things that I think in this story Jesus was saying to the Pharisees about how to using your resources for him, thinking more about your life now than worrying about, you know, going to heaven and the future, and finally caring more about what you choose to do and not worrying so much about what you're not supposed to do. But let's flip it around and look at Lazarus's point of view. What can we say about him? Well, forgotten, I think. Ignored. In pain. That image of the dog licking his sores is not something that would have brought him comfort. I think that's sometimes attributed to this story. Well, at least he had this dog coming and licking him. I think dog saliva is not well known as a salve for ulcerated skin. That would have been uncomfortable and painful. And it would have been humiliating. So forgotten, ignored, in pain, humiliated. You know, who here hasn't ever felt like that? In this story, we can imagine we're rich, because we are, and feel uncomfortable about, you know, the message God is giving about how we use our resources. But actually, I think all of us have been poor as well and can associate with those feelings. And there's a message of comfort in this for us. I want to tell you a story. I've got time. I've got a couple of minutes left. And some of you will know bits of this story, but I don't think I've ever told the whole story for maybe, goodness, possibly 20 years. These pictures are from a long time ago, you can tell, because that's actually me, not my son. And I spent a year of my life in Kazakhstan. This is back in the late 1990s. It was fairly recently free of the Soviet Union, although there was still a big communist presence. Culturally, it was an interesting split. There was sort of half white Russian sort of communists who, you know, harked back to the Soviet era and loved it. And then half sort of native Kazakh, who were sort of nominal Muslims, is the best way to put it. They knew culturally they should be Muslims, but they didn't really know quite what that meant. So it'd be about halfway into Ramadan, and they'd be like, is it Ramadan? Yeah, I think it is. What are we supposed to do? I'm not really sure. That's genuinely how the cultural setting. And I was there working as a missionary, trying to set up a Christian student movement. So this is my English class behind me here. I didn't go there to teach English. I went to teach other things. But they, in the university, had signed up to do English literature, and they had no teacher. So as I was the only English person in town, they said, will you be our teacher? So I ended up teaching English. And that was the summer, which was lovely. It was always about 40 degrees in the summer, very hot. In the winter, it was minus 40, and that's me with a friend waiting for a bus in the winter. But the story is this, because this is the time where I felt most poor in my life and can associate with the beggar in this story. Because there was one moment during my time there where I fell quite ill. I had pain here in my lower right-hand side. Doctor came out to look at it and said, you've got appendicitis. And it was quite severe. And I had a choice. I could either get on a plane to the capital city, which I'd have to wait about 12 hours for a flight. It would take another 3 hours to get there. Anyway, it was going to take about a day to get to an American medical center where I could have an operation in the way you and I would think of an operation. Or I could go to the local medical center, which was Bolnitsa Chetvyorta, I think it was called. It's hospital number 4, creatively titled. Where they could deal with it straight away, but they're not a very well-equipped place. Anyway, I'll cut the story short. On the advice of the doctor, I went to this medical center. They did the operation. They didn't have anesthetic or anything in like that, so it was just wooden bench, alcohol to kind of cool it down. So I'm lying there on a wooden bench, literally holding kind of leather straps. It's like everything you've thought of in films about this sort of thing. Sort of shaved, and just cut open. My scar is not like any scars you've probably got for appendices. It's about 7 or 8 inches or something. It was quite traumatic, in pain, certainly humiliated, cold, struggling with the language. But the point of the story really is what happened afterwards, because after that operation, I got taken into a ward, and I was there for a week, I think. And this is not a place that has any catering. You know, there's no catering at this particular hospital. You are entirely reliant on your family to look after you during your recovery period. But I didn't have any family. But that whole week, for me, as I sort of lay there in this bed, just feeling really, like I had nothing. I didn't have any money. I got paid about $20 US a month just for working. It was enough to survive on, but there wasn't a lot of spare money to go around. So I didn't have any money. I didn't have family there. But there was a succession of people that came to me every day, bringing food, books to read, people that would just sit and talk with me. It was my students. And sometimes when they couldn't come, it was members of their family. I have these old women turning up who I've never seen before, and it was the mothers of these girls that I was teaching who would bring food and sit and talk to me. Mostly about the possibility of me marrying their daughter, actually. which I didn't take any of them up on it. But in my moment, and that for me in my life was my moment of greatest poverty. Because whilst I would consider myself wealthy now, I certainly wasn't then, I had nothing. It was in that moment where I think in terms of my mission there and the reason why I was there, I was most fulfilled. because there are other men in that ward with me. One guy, I remember, they hadn't known what was wrong with him. They just cut him open from neck to belly to open him up to see if they could figure out what was wrong. And he came back the following day saying, "We didn't find anything." He was next to me. And he was so amazed at the variety of people that were coming in to visit me. I couldn't do anything but talk about the Bible study groups that we're running with these people in the evenings and so on. I've never shared the gospel more effectively than I did when I was at my most poor. And so, you know, that's the final message, really, that when you look at this story from the point of view of being the beggar, being Lazarus, and we will all have had moments in our lives, maybe they don't make quite as good after dinner story as this, my operation, but we've had moments, and maybe you're feeling now you feel poor. That's the final message of this story, is that Jesus cares. If you feel like Lazarus, he will lift you up. We may not feel the same beauty of the imagery that somebody in Jesus' times would have felt, because going into Abraham's arms, you know, going to an old man's arms, an old man you've never met before, might not seem that appealing to you now. But it was an image for them of one of comfort. That's where they would want to be above all other places, in Father Abraham's arms. So the final truth is that Jesus cares. And that, I hope, is the confidence behind this week's Dare. We're in the Truth or Dare series still. So I just want to introduce some final video I want you to see, and then I want to talk about what the dare for the week might be.
Our person of the week. Sitting in the crowd of thousands at the Arizona Diamondbacks game, a 12-year-old boy watching the game, about to do something that would catch not only their eyes in the announcer's booth, but ours too. We couldn't believe what we were seeing.
It was the fourth inning. A player tosses a ball into the stands. Two little boys wanted it, but only Ian McMillan would get it.
Oh, look at that young Brewers fan. Now, wait a minute. He is... Did he get...
No.
Oh, boy.
He is sour. He is sour. The Diamondback fan got it.
The announcer's watching with their own play-by-play.
Oh, he's bummed out.
Are you kidding me? This kid's going to do this?
Oh, yeah. That is big time.
Oh, my goodness.
What a nice young man.
Well, he's got a Diamondbacks hat, but we have to get something for that kid in the red. I can't believe I just witnessed that.
That is awesome.
You young man are a star.
The game would go on, Ian having given up his prized catch, but then a phone call. It seemed someone had seen his kindness on TV.
He's being told right now that he's being praised on TV.
Yeah, he's big league.
Late today, we met Ian too.
I thought it was the right thing to do. Like, I saw the kid, he was really sad, so I decided just to give the ball back. And my mom and my dad, taught me that way, so it's kind of just, like, natural.
Ian didn't leave that game empty-handed. Moments after giving that ball away, the announcers had a special gift for the fan, a baseball bat signed by his favorite player.
Upped an autographed bat and a contract for the generous Ian and his buddies.
The box was really, really cool. I was, like, really surprised, and, like, I did not see that coming.
He's got good home training.
That's a very well-bred young man.
If you do good things will happen to you.
Reminding us all that often what you give...
Nice going, young man.
...delivers far more in return than even a little boy could imagine.
And so we choose Ian McMillan with a lesson for us all. And we learned late today that after talking to us, he was off to throw out the first pitch at tonight's Diamondbacks game. Go get him, Ian.
So this week's dare is to dare to commit an act of outrageous generosity, is the way I've put it. You know, if you hear this story and you identify with the rich man, then that in and of itself is motivation to think about how you can be more generous with the resources you have. If you identify with Lazarus, then it still is comfort that whatever you choose to give, God cares and God will reward you. So think about what that is. Maybe it's, cooking a meal for your neighbour, or putting £100 through someone's letterbox that you know needs it more than you. Or something wild, like go to a big issue seller and instead of buying one big issue, buy the whole stack and give them a ticket to the cinema, or I don't know. Think, you know, you know for yourselves what it might be for you, and you know, it's still the gift giving time within this church. If this church has been an important community and support to you, then maybe that's your area of generosity too. But the main message I hope you get from looking at that parable this morning is that Jesus cares. He won't let you down, so let's dare to be generous with the things that he's given us. Thanks.